Hey Tim, when were you born?
Jan, you know the answer to that. We are in fact the same age. I was born in 1984.
Yeah, of course I know the answer. Pretty cool. And you know what? That is exactly the year when our today's guest started in pre-sales.
Oh, wow. That is a long time veteran than it seems. And therefore the reason why this episode is even possible. Sales Excellence, your podcast for software B2B sales and pre-sales. My name is Tim and I'm a solution consultant at Seismic.
And I'm Jan, I'm a pre-sales leader at SAP. So welcome to our new episode.
Yeah, and let me do the intros. So today's guest has started his career in technical-oriented sales roles for about 10 years. He did that and then, in fact, stepped into management. And now some of you listeners might have to look into the history books. He was, in fact, the first pre-sales manager hired by Tom Siebel. So whoever doesn't know Tom Siebel, definitely look it up. It's worthwhile. And and he then progressed into technical pre-sales leadership positions up to VP levels and at some point said, okay, I've had enough. I'm going to run my own company. And now since 13 years, he has been running a company called Mastering Technical Sales. And whoever knows Jan and myself, we often are we're trying to convince our listeners and our surrounding people that we work with that this, in fact, is a book worth reading, because that's also the name of the book. So I've already talked too much. Welcome to the show, John Kerr.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here, gents. So really looking forward to having a great conversation with you about all things connected with sales engineering.
Yeah, welcome. And Tim, just a side note, it was my very first gift to you, right? Very first gift to Tim.
That is absolutely right. That I think you gave it to me on our first day, well, working for you in, what was it, 2017 it was, or no, 18, at the beginning of 18.
That's correct, yeah.
I mean, the book is not for today's topic. I do have one question for you, though, John. The book, I have it here next to me, in fact. Well, I'm showing it to the camera. The audience
okay.
won't be able to
here,
see
it. I'll autograph it for you. So just hold it up to the camera. There you go. All right.
Thank you for that autograph.
You're welcome.
But, you've written it together with Erin Bolick.
Right. Yes.
And I mean, I would say Jan and myself, we try to keep our minds and eyes and ears open to anything that is around sales engineering and pre-sales, right? However, Erin Bolick is the only time I saw that name is because he's a co-author of that book. Uh-huh. And I'm really curious, what is he doing now? Are you still friends with him? What's going on there?
Oh, yes. So Erin and I chat probably every 3 or 4 months. He is recently married and is living on a island down in the Caribbean. So he has a pretty sweet life right now, well away from the pandemic. Yeah, he's doing pretty well for himself. He stepped out of sales engineering many, many years ago.
Right.
So when we wrote the book, I did a lot of what you might call the practical side of the book, and Erin did a little bit more of the theoretical, time management and things like that side of the book. So that's how we divided the content back then. So that's why Erin's on the spine of the book.
Yeah, and here you often hear authors say writing a book will not make you rich, but it seems like, well, maybe Erin did something else on top of that.
No, it has nothing to do with the book royalties, trust me.
Fair enough. So let's dive into the topic, because today we really want to talk about the evolution of pre-sales. And I cannot think of a better person to have this conversation with than you, because you obviously have a lot of experience in the space. We teased in the beginning with 1984, and correct me if I'm wrong, that is the year where you started working in pre-sales, isn't it?
Yes. So at this point, anyone watching a video is going to be saying, gosh, he can't possibly be that old. But that is actually true. So my first job as a sales engineer, I took working actually in Princeton, New Jersey in the summer of 1984. So I have 36 years of experience in the industry, in and out. So pretty scary. A lot's changed.
And this is the topic we want to talk about today, how the evolution of pre-sales sort of moved. But maybe you can take us into 1984 a little bit. And like, how was it working as a pre-sales person in that year? Like, was it already about software? Did you have to carry like your computer with to the prospect, or like how did daily life look like for you?
So many things are not that different from what sales engineers do now in terms of the basic role, which was to be, in effect, the technical conscience of the sales rep, to go out there, do product demos, business discovery, run proof of concepts, answer RFPs. So those fundamental things haven't changed over, three, four decades. Now, the technology and the process that we use to do that has changed dramatically. Back then, almost all software ran on these honking great big IBM mainframes. And certainly the company that I worked for, a company called Mathematica, we ran everything on IBM mainframes. So when we had to go out and do like a proof of concept or an install, we had these great big like 9-inch tape, right? So that's whatever, like 25 centimeters, right? So big tapes, magnetic tapes. We'd have to go into this special room, sign out a set of tapes, put those tapes usually kind of in the back of our car. We'd also, if you're a good sales engineer, you had a secret set of tapes as well, which is your backup special set of tapes, because the other ones didn't always work. And you'd usually drive to the customer site or fly and then turn up. You'd hope the systems programmer had actually woken up before noon and was ready to come and help you install your software. You'd go install it. There were always problems. And then you'd run through everything else. So, contrast that to the cloud now, where you can light up the system in about 3 nanoseconds, like up there in the cloud. That part of the world has changed dramatically for sales engineers. So, I don't want to sound like the boring old guy, though back in the day, I think it was considerably harder for sales engineers just to do the technical side of their job. And gosh, I mean, the equipment, right? So yes, we ran everything back then on IBM mainframes. If we couldn't run something on the client's mainframe, we had to dial in back to headquarters. We had a 300 board modem. So there's no K or M in front of that 300 board, and we'd have to dial back and we'd be typing in and do a remote demo on a tiny little screen presenting to the customer.
Okay, wow. So that was already possible.
Yeah, it was possible. And the trick we always had was, there was always a phone cord, that went out from the side of your machine. We haven't even talked about the big IBM PCs yet, from your machine that went to the phone jack in the local conference room. So you always had to make sure there was a phone jack available in the conference room for you to plug into. And the trick you learned very quickly as a sales engineer was you'd actually wrap the phone cord around your foot. So if anything went wrong with the demo or something was going to crash, you quickly yanked with your foot, connected the phone system, and then you could blame AT&T over here in the US. So that was the trick. What we use at the front end, right now, the three of us either have a laptop or a great tablet in front of us. I mean, the power I have in this HP machine in front of me is like orders of magnitude more than what we had back then. So we demoed on some of the very first IBM PCs that had 512K of memory. And if you were lucky, a 5 megabyte hard drive. Like most of the time you had to put things in on floppy drives and run things off there. So that was the life of time to the sales engineer back then. And those things weighed like so much. It was unbelievable. And so that was usually the job of the sales rep. So it was the job of the sales rep to actually carry the equipment in, because it weighed like kilos and kilos and kilos of stuff. The rep had to do something useful other than get coffee. So that was normally his or her job.
Okay, so every prospect meeting became like a little physical workout for maybe even both of you, right? Carrying all that necessary equipment, the cords, and so on.
It did, and that continued for years. I mean, because even when you got to the point of having little sun spark stations, microvaxes, things like that, those things still weigh a lot. You normally cart those around in some trolley. So I have all kinds of horror stories of, being on the New York subway or the Washington, D.C., underground subway and going from one station to another and trying to look for an elevator to get the equipment up. So, yeah, anybody my age can tell you those stories.
So then a really tactical question, because now I'm actually quite curious. Maybe there's something to learn here for today's time as well. So obviously, there's hardware involved. You then have your IBM machines and everything. But the one thing that we often discuss here on this podcast is how to manage the attention span of your audience. So Jan and I often talk about like TST loops, or maybe using like a whiteboard, or maybe using PowerPoint slides across, well, not only just software, right? You don't want to start a four-hour meeting just jumping into software and then stay there for 4 hours. You want to sort of keep the attention alive. How did you manage that in those times?
So I've been a big fan of the whiteboard for years, except back then it was actually a blackboard. So it was a blackboard with white chalk and colored chalk. Right. So you, if possible, you would request a conference room that had both a blackboard in it and a phone jack. Every good sales engineer had carried their own packet of chalk with them, actually, you know, in the bag. And so I would love to sketch things out. And I think that's where my love of whiteboarding has come from. I discovered that was a great way to get messaging across all those years back. And you didn't just want to dive immediately into the demo. Because bear in mind the presentation mechanism we had then, there was no such thing as PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. So everything was done on 35 millimeter slides in the slide deck. So you'd
like
have a little
physical slide deck.
Yeah, a physical
like
slide
a projector.
Deck. So you'd have a carousel projector.
Yes.
You know, they either had 80 or 120 little holes in it to put the slides in. So you'd also have to make sure there was somewhere to project in the room. You could turn the lights out. And then, you know, the rep would do the same thing, do 8 or 10 slides up front. That was the corporate overview. And then it was, you know, for the next 50 minutes, here's the sales engineer. And you'd show some slides. And then I learned very quickly to, you know, put the lights back on. And to, you know, show a piece of software or to sketch something, and then we put the lights back off and show something else. So I think even back then we tried to do things in, you know, chunks of 15 minutes, 20 minutes or less, solely because of the attention span. We didn't know why at that point. We, you know, the science wasn't there, so we just knew it worked. Now there's all these studies that tell you about, you know, the heartbeat and the attention curve and everything else. But you know, just think about it. I mean, there's this saying, right? You know, even now when PowerPoint comes on, right, the lights go off. And the lights go off literally in the room as well as in your customer's head. Now, imagine that with slides. You could guarantee there's always one slide that was reversed or upside down. You know, and it's the trick that we senior sales engineers will play on junior sales engineers. When they weren't looking, we'd grab a couple of their slides and flip them around in their decks. You know, so it was all fun.
So you really had a lot of fun back in 1984.
You had to, right? Yeah.
I mean, I would think if you have a slide upside down, that surely will grab the attention of everyone in the room immediately. So you could call that a limbic technique, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, in regards to what you just said, I mean, that is actually an awesome technique. And I'm already wondering whether that is something we can apply, like turning the light on and off in a room. I mean, I've never done that in the past 10 years giving technical presentations. But of course, well, in those times you had to because the light was not powerful enough to illuminate a wall in daylight, yes. Right? Today we have that. But turning light on and off, that is an attention grabber, I would say, irrespective of what you're doing there, because you will just wake up, I suppose.
Yeah, and you really had no choice, because even when you were projecting off your PC, at least in the mid-80s, you know, normally you'd have a little projection device that would display it, or it would transmit onto a little device you'd put on an overhead projector, then the overhead projector would display something on the wall. So everything was hardware-driven, and it was big, it was clunky, it weighed a lot, they were hard to get. So there's a lot more logistics that went into planning a sales call on site, customer site, you know, to the point where we actually had little checklists, you know, prepared that we give customers. You know, do you have a phone jack? You know, is there a blackboard available? You know, can you, you know, tell me about the lighting? Like all these things that we don't think about anymore now.
The funny thing is, however, I would argue we should, because I have come up to two customer meetings and then all of a sudden they say, yeah, why don't you hook your PC up to the projector? And then all of a sudden I see like a VGA cable there, no HDMI. Yeah. Or you go there and then we discover, oh, there's only a guest Wi-Fi and we don't have the login credentials, right? So making sure these type of things are set up, I mean, keeping in mind that right now we don't do physical meetings, but yeah. Hopefully at some point we will do again. Having such a checklist is still today, I believe, still a good idea. The last thing before we maybe move on to one of the more recent time periods is, you mentioned it's quite a logistical effort to get these sort of meetings sorted. Did that in any way impact the deal cycle length? Did it take longer to close deals at the time, or did that not really make a difference?
I don't think it made a difference. No. certainly one thing I've noticed over the years is I think the number of people from the customer side who get engaged and have to sign off on deals seems to have increased, you know, particularly from the early 2000s to, you know, the later 2000s, just the number of people you'd have to sell to. So you still had to build consensus, but it required fewer people to sign off on it, I think, back then. So that maybe countered the fact that, you know, it would quite often take you a week or 10 days to, you know, find a suitable time for the client, make sure you can get everybody there, your equipment available, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think they balanced out.
So if we jump now a little bit forward, maybe we move into the 90s, maybe even the early 2000s. I mean, my guess would be, of course, as general technology advanced, some of the more logistical challenges that you just elaborated on sort of became easier and easier. But how did the pre-sales, or how was your pre-sales life, so to say, in the next sort of 10, 20 years, if we jump like that, sort of changed? You already hinted at the general, on a conceptual way, the pre-sales role hasn't really changed much, but obviously some things must have changed, and maybe you can shed some light for us on that one.
So again, the actual job role itself didn't change that much. There were still the basic things that sales engineers do now. I think what did change was the actual technology that drives it, potentially the presentation mechanisms itself. So I joined Oracle in 1988, so it was a $81 million company at that point. At the point I joined, I was we call them sales consultants. So we were a sales consultant, solution consultant, manager, and I had like one employee. And by the time I left, I had either like 50 or 60 scattered all over the United States. So the company was just growing like crazy. But so did the underlying technology. So, you know, by the time 1990 rolled around, we had these like wonderful Toshiba laptops. So, you know, they weren't battery driven, they were plugged in, but you could demonstrate a pretty massive chunk of the Oracle portfolio just on these Toshiba laptops. And if you were a really good SE, you managed to have both Microsoft Windows running on it and IBM OS 2, which you needed for some of the other Oracle products. And you imagine two different operating systems running on a laptop back then. I think the hard drive was 200 or 400 megabytes at that point. So still wasn't massive, but it made demoing the product a lot easier. Plus, a good part of the Oracle portfolio was PC-based, or it supported client-server. So you could use the PC as a front end, and we'd have a VAX, a Sun system or something, sitting back in our local home office that we could dial into. So we even managed to disconnect some from some of the corporate systems. So I think that kind of decentralization of demos really started happening in the late 80s and the early 90s. And it just picked up more and more and more as the technology got faster and better, and drives were faster, memory was easier. I mean, to be hired as an SE in Oracle in the late 80s, you had to know how to take your laptop apart, and you'd have to install extended memory cards and chips and all kinds of other things. You could actually run Oracle on the PC to start with and go out and demo that.
So obviously at the time, it was all still on-premise. So am I right to assume that you had to literally install that on-premise software on your laptop to actually demo it? Is that how it works?
You had the client installed on the laptop. The backend, the server, right, though, could be anywhere. It's a predecessor to the cloud, as it was, and you didn't care where the backend server was. It could have been our local office in New Jersey, or it could have been in corporate headquarters in California. It could have been anywhere else in the world, as long as you could get to it. So that's why it made things a lot easier, because you had all the freedom in the world as an SE to do stuff on the front end, but the back end was somewhere else and, secure. For the larger operations, that made life a lot easier as an SE, communications issues aside.
Yeah. So you did talk a little bit about the number of stakeholders involved at a prospect, and you said your observation is that it has increased, especially also like in the last 10, 20 years or so. And I think that's pretty much in line with what companies like Channel and Jazzale and so on that bring regular studies on the number of stakeholders involved in business-to-business buying decisions, which I think is right now, the current estimate sits at like 12 stakeholders or something like that, which is even higher, going up from 7 it was like 5 years ago. So that trend seems to be continuing. Who were you talking to during those times? In the 90s or so, was it already business people that would have the business case at heart, or was it very much a technical conversation with like IT people?
It was both. So for example, if we were selling into like Johnson & Johnson or Glaxo, some of the pharmaceutical mm-hmm. companies, so we'd certainly deal with the folks in R&D. So we'd actually sometimes have scientists, research scientists in the meeting who were interested in how they could utilize our software to help them do better drug discovery and molecular modeling. We'd have a CIO, but you might also have some of the sales and marketing people in there as well. So it tended to be a mix of people, probably more technical than business. At least back then, it was usually mm-hmm. The CIO who held the budget. But still need to get sign off from people outside of the IT organization to support the needs of the business itself, research and development or somebody like that. So even back then, the easiest sales that we made, if there's such a thing as an easy sale, is when we had the business people pressuring IT to do something, and we were something. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair enough.
And in addition to that, John, what I'm interested in, so you said the role itself has changed, technology changed and made it a lot easier. So in the 80s and in the 90s, would you say it was easier to convince your customer, let's say, with the product, right? If I look at, for example, the CRM space today, right? We have so many different CRM providers, and mm-hmm. on the first glance, they all look the same, right? So I can't really make a difference by, hey, I have the coolest CRM product. Was there a difference, or was it already the kind of full package and your engagement and all that stuff? Or was it kind of easier to just buy the product with the product and not all that other stuff we're seeing today?
So Jan, like most things in sales engineering, I think the answer is classic. It depends on what you are selling. So if you are selling IT infrastructure products, so what I call IT plumbing, networking, servers, storage, things like that, it still was primarily a feature function type sale, because it was technology for technology's sake, that ultimately solves some business problem. If you were more like SAP, for example, on the application side, then you tended to get a lot more of the business people involved. And you mentioned CRM. So I worked for two CRM companies at the end of the 90s, a company called Vantiv, which ended up getting purchased by PeopleSoft, which became Oracle, and then a company called Clarify, which got bought by Nortel and then, ended up in Amdocs or something. And so what we discovered was, we just had to be technical enough so that the techies took no exception, right? So our job as the techies to make sure they didn't say no. And then our job was primarily to convince the business people, which in that case was either sales or the support desk or field services or maintenance, that this was something they really wanted. And at that point, we were competing with Siebel. So Siebel Systems was the big Salesforce automation gorilla back then. And they had a very, very technical sale, which doesn't sound like a Tom Siebel company, but they did. So we very quickly learned to compete with them. We really had to go after like the VP of sales, for example, and convince the VP of sales what a difference it was going to make to his or her life. And so that was the primary focus at both of those companies. And we found if we were successful doing that, we were far more likely to get the deal than if we were talking about, DLLs and stuff like that to the IT folks.
Okay. So, to wrap it up, in that case, also not a huge difference, right? So still focusing on the right people and having that business talk instead of just showing feature function was also your kind of rule for success. And of course, it depends what you're selling. I'm mainly referring to software.
Yeah, it was, except back then, SEs weren't always hired because they had business acumen. So they were hired because they were super technical. They knew the product inside and out, could talk about all the features and the options and everything else. And if it just so happened they can link that back to business, that was even better. So it wasn't necessarily a direct hiring requirement. Whereas, now, particularly over the last 10 years, deep technical knowledge is, you know, it's a requirement, but it's poker stakes, I like to say. And there's now all these other consultative requirements that we as sales engineers have layered on top of it that weren't maybe, you know, that explicit when you were hiring SEs 20, 25 years ago. So that has changed, I think, just the general hiring profile and what you're looking for in the, you know, the larger companies.
Would you say that this shift in consciousness of what the right person would be for a pre-sales job is mainly influenced by the fact that we have moved into the cloud and the underlying technicalities, like what type of programming language, what type of APIs am I using, has really gone into the background and the business has been realized to be the forefront of a decision maker? Do you think that is the reason for that?
Actually, no. I think that it's more a requirement of what customers want from the sales engineers that they are working with. So it used to be, as I said, if you just knew all about the features and functions and could explain how they work to the techies, you were a great sales engineer. And then maybe 20 years ago, you know, when dot-com boom happened and then blew up, after that, I think that's where customers started demanding the more consultative, you know, consultant role that we are moving towards today. There's a study of ours that I love to cite, and we just updated it, gosh, like 7-8 months ago. We went out there and we asked 2,300 plus mid to senior level executives, like all around the world, in like Fortune 1000 companies, what are the top skills that you require from pre-sales engineers? Right, so that's specifically the job that we do. The number one thing they said was, I want someone who understands my business. Now, do you need to understand the day-to-day minutiae of, you know, R&D at pharmaceuticals or, you know, trading stocks at, you know, Goldman Sachs? No, but you need to know enough to understand the basics of it and their language. Number two was someone who can help design innovative solutions with my staff. Right, so innovative is a keyword there, and with my staff, not for my staff. Number three is someone who can clearly and effectively communicate with me. So it's no good understanding my business or being innovative if you can't actually explain it to me. Number four was someone I can trust to do the right thing for me and my company. Right, so that's the trusted advisor sales engineer right there. And number five, trailing, was someone who has deep technical knowledge. And if you look at the stats behind it, the top four had confidence factors like 80, 85%. So almost everybody said that. Deep technical knowledge was 42%, which is why I say it's table stakes. So it's now an expectation that you have it, or you can go get it and bring it to bear for your customer. And now all these other consultative skills are now in demand by our customers. Whereas the role of the salesperson, I would suggest, has barely changed from 20 years ago. If you think about what they do, I mean, their technology has changed and how they do it. But the expectations from the customer really hasn't budged that much. So I think the role of the SE has had gone through massive shifts over the last 20 years, and it's continued to do that. I mean, the role is just modifying rapidly just in the last 18 months, which I think makes it fun. It's why we won't be automated out of existence, because no one will ever exactly figure out what we do. So how can you code for that?
And this is a topic I would like to go into, but maybe before we do that sort of future outlook, I mean, you've said it before that, of course, technology is advancing. And I guess one of the main reasons for that is also Moore's law, right? Transistors are becoming smaller, computing capacity increases exponentially, innovation, therefore, is increasing exponentially.
Well, if it's the rate of change, what's interesting is that rarely is there something radically new that comes into sales. And you start reading about new sales processes, the Challenger sale and stuff like that. But it's all been done before. And I had this realization when within my company, we teach a class called Business Value Discovery. And it's basically don't talk tech until you understand what the business drivers are. And it's the number one class that we teach throughout the world in whatever, six different languages. What's interesting is underlying it, there's this little document we have called the Key Business Issues Worksheet. Want to take a guess when when I designed version 1.0 of that KBI, Key Business Issues Worksheet was? Like, what do you think was the date when I first built that sheet? Quiz for you.
2005.
1989.
Okay, Jan wins. It was 1989 or 1990.
And the question, I guess, is how often has it changed?
Oh, radically. I mean, I think I designed it using Lotus 1-2-3 and WordPerfect on like Windows 3.0 or something. But the very first version of it is 30 years old. I mean, I went back and looked at it, at least a printout of it. And I mean, it's changed and it's modified since then. But a lot of things we talk about, I talk about being the fabulous sales engineer, which stands for features, advantages, and benefits. That concept was first designed in 1988 by Spin Selling, right? Neil Rackham. Mm-hmm. So he came up with it back then, 30 plus years ago again. So a lot of things just come in cycles.
Give it a new name.
Just give it a new name, a new coat of paint, right? Let the marketing people have it. Exactly. Someone like Gartner puts some veneer on.
New price tag, and then you can earn some money.
Yeah, so you got it, Jan. Yes.
To be honest, for me, this is already a massive takeaway, because on many of the things, such as like consultative value selling, etc., for me, in my mind, those were more recent and more current developments. But clearly, I was mistaken, right? Because based on what you say, that has always been important, which makes sense, yes. Right? Businesses don't make buying decisions of like hundreds of thousands of dollars just like that. There needs to be, there's always a way how people are working and how decisions are being made. And so it doesn't make sense that fundamental aspect of it actually hasn't changed that much.
I mean, there's been sales processes forever. I mean, folks who used to go door to door selling encyclopedias and vacuum cleaners and things like that. I mean, they had a step-by-step process that they learned over the years in terms of what would help them sell more. It's actually why I wrote the book, just to do a little diversion. So the genesis story of writing the book was, it's 1999. I'm sitting in my fifth sales process training of my career already, and it's 1999. And it's a week long, solution selling. And it's Friday lunchtime. And I turned to this lady, Sandy, who worked for me, one of my managers. I said, Sandy, why are we here? It's 5 days of training. Only a day and a half of it is relevant to us as sales engineers. And we can absorb it three times faster than all these salespeople. Right? So even back then, SEs and salespeople went at it. And she just turned around and looked at me and said, if you're so smart, why don't you write a book about it? I said, you know what? That's what I'm going to do. And that was the genesis story of my entire company, how it got started. It was out of sheer frustration because nobody provided training to us that's specific to our role. We always had to sit in the back of the room and listen to sales process training, negotiation training, objection handling. And you could synthesize it as a sales engineer, but it wasn't directly pointed at us. That's why I wrote the book. And it turned into what we have now, which is kind of humbling, really, right? So that's a long way of saying, yes, you're right. Sales processes have been around for many, many, many years.
Yep. You said you had another question.
Yeah. So my initial thought when I was talking about like exponential developments within technology is that I wanted to come to more recent times, maybe like the last 10 years or so, from 2010 to 2020, potentially. And you're saying, okay, even the past 18 months, things have already tremendously changed also for you as part of the company that you have, but also for pre-sellers out there that are doing the job in the field. And so what type of changes were you referring to? Do you have like the top three in mind where you would say this is quite a shift?
Sure. So one is just doing virtual sales calls. Even before March of 2020, companies were doing a significant proportion of their customer sales calls virtually. Over Zoom, Team, Meet, whatever. And here in the US, many enterprise sales engine organizations were telling me that 40% of their customer calls are being done virtually. This is 2018 and 2019. That number was lower in Europe and much lower in APAC, kind of a cultural thing. So, virtual interactions with customers were definitely on the rise before, we got into the current situation that we're in now. Underlying technology, I mean, virtualization, I think the first demo system we had on a virtual machine was 2002, right? That's just enabled SEs to set up demo systems and play systems and sandboxes and things like that a lot easier. And then just the general cloudification of the market, just having everything up there within reach and you can spin it up quickly, demo it, do whatever you want with it and then shut it down. I think that's kind of a radical change for us in terms of the technology that we use. So, you know, those are some of the growth changes that I've seen broadly over the last 10 or 15 years. If you come to the last couple of years, I would say that the low end part, almost the boring part of the job of the sales engineer, is being automated, which is fantastic. So, you know, there's been RFP tools out there for years. Now, the last 18 months, they've gotten a lot smarter. There's a lot more of them. And you can essentially do close to 90%, I'd say, of an RFP or RFI response and automate it. And then you have the human touch that goes on around it. That's fantastic. Basic demos, like quote, out of the box demo, or even having a customer come to your website and check a few boxes of getting a somewhat of a custom demo that's built on the fly. That's happening. So, you know, organizations, again, you know, a year ago that had inside sales engineers, the inside sales engineers are no longer just, you know, the demo monkeys doing demo. Now what they're doing tends to be more focused, a bit more customized, you know, more directed towards the individual customer. And it's not just mass market stuff. So a lot of the low end, low value things that we as sales engineers are being taken off our plate, which I think is awesome because it lets us focus on the high end stuff, you know, around the classic solution design, architecture, you know, simplification of our clients' environments, giving them different ideas about how to restructure and change their business processes, you know, to help with revenue, cost, and risk, and things like that. So it lets us use a different part of our brain now when we're engaging with customers, and that's just accelerating. You know, I mean, I've seen holographic demo systems, and we're going to see those in about 12 months. There are companies that have, you know, AI bots monitoring proof of concepts that their customers doing up in the cloud. So rather than the SE having to look at these POCs, these bots are just checking, seeing what customers are doing. And if they start going off the rails or there's an issue or something else, then the bot notifies the SE. So again, that, you know, that basic monitoring that you have to do, that's getting taken off your plate. You know, the size of a deal that can be done with an unattended proof or eval, those are increasing too. So I think it's really exciting times to be a sales engineer.
Yeah, I share that sentiment. I mean, funny enough, it's a bit of a personal story, but when I was a child, and I still am into science fiction, right? I love science fiction books. I love science fiction movies. And that always has been the case. And as a child, I was always thinking, man, I want to live in that future because it's so exciting with the technology and everything. And the older I become, the more I realize I live in that time because the technological advancement is so fast that every single year there's something new out there, which you maybe even thought about 12 months ago. So it's, yeah, it's a lot of things to discover. And for me personally, it's extremely exciting. And also one of the reasons why I love technology so much and why the pre-sales role is so much fun, because it's just so much development. So if we take what you just told us and we sort of maybe look into the crystal ball, and maybe we look 5, maybe we look even 10 years into the future. And of course, we'll not be able to make an accurate prediction here, but we can play a little bit with that. Do you believe the pre-sales role will still be of relevance in 5 years from now, for example, for business-to-business buying decisions?
Absolutely. You know, I wouldn't be doing this otherwise. And the number one reason I say that is because our customers want us to be there. There was those 5 skills I talked about that mid to senior level execs want from us. One of the other really interesting studies we did is over the last year and a half, in conjunction with one of my clients and a consulting company, we asked about 8,000 people in the corporate world, both, you know, individuals in IT, mid-level managers and execs, you know, who provides the most value to you and your people during the sales process? And the answer comes back overwhelmingly, you know, 2-1, it's the sales engineer. Mid-level management says they find twice as much value from the sales engineer as they do from the sales rep that he or she works with. Individuals in IT, it's about 2.5 times, that's no big surprise. And even the executives in our client base say, you know, it's almost a 2-1 ratio. So, and when you drill down on it, it's just because it's the SE who understands how the stuff actually works, what other clients are doing with it, you know, both the prescribed uses for the technology and the off-label uses, you know, the weird and wonderful things that our clients find to do with our stuff that we've never even thought of, and is actually the voice of the customer and can take enhancement requests and feedback back to marketing and to product management, you know, and vice versa. So when you look at it from that point of view, the demand is out there. That really, I think the role of the sales engineer is still going to keep expanding, particularly in the networking relationship side of things. We're not going to become salespeople. You know, I think as soon as you cross over that line, except for a few industries, you tend to lose a bit of the trust and credibility rather than get more. But I think the whole concept of how many people within the customer does the sales engineer know, I think that number is just going to be increasing and increasing over the next 5 to 10 years, because there's no one else within a software tech vendor who can so quickly become the trusted advisor to the client as we can. And I just don't see how that's going to change.
Yeah, fair enough. So if I were to challenge that a little bit, then it would mean account executives will be replaced by an AI much earlier than we will.
For the low end, there is that possibility, yes. Think about the automobile industry right now, car sales.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I do very much agree with you that within pre-sales, and for me personally, that is very much the case as well, could benefit having more direct connections to our prospects people. So the people that we work with in my daily life, it's quite often the account executive who's reaching out directly to the stakeholders at the customer. Yes, I'm on CC on those mails. I'm invited to the calls and so on. Do I proactively reach out? Yes, sometimes I do. But the picture you were painting just now is we would actually be even of more value if we were to have more of those direct relationships.
Yes.
How do you see that working alongside the general focus a pre-seller needs to bring to his job in order to think about a compelling story, building together a compelling demo system? Mm-hmm. It requires a lot of focus work, which for me is in contrast to point communication to different stakeholders at the prospect. Can I bring those two together in one role, in fact?
Yes, you can. And it's what your clients want you to do. Here's a little thought experiment. So here I am, John Kerr, CIO at New Rocket Skates, right? My favorite fictitious company. And the two of you are making a sales call on me. Let's pretend it's in the before times and you're physically sitting in my office. So I have Tim and I have Jan. So let's see, who looks more like the sales engineer? Tim, I think you look a little bit more like the sales engineer. So Tim, you're going to be the SE. Jan, you're going to be the sales. Okay, sorry about that, but hey, you know.
No worries.
You get to drive a BMW or a Porsche or something, so you're good. So you're sitting there in my office, and let's assume I've had no previous communications with you other than a bit of email, and my admins told me that you're coming in and who you're from. So Tim's the SE, Jan's the salesperson. Just inherently, who do I trust more, Tim or Jan?
Yeah, history says probably me, right? Because I don't necessarily want to sell. Yeah.
And so the reason is, and it's so simplistic, but when I think back to when I was an exec and I talked to my fellow execs and the research we do now, the way they fundamentally think is, Jan is here to sell me something. Tim is here to help me. And the really smart salespeople, and Jan is one of those really smart salespeople, know that. So they'll kind of let you, Tim, do what you're really good at in order to establish the trust and the credibility with the customer. And if that means, Tim, that you're the one who has the long-term relationship with me as a CIO, because I'm going to get more out of it than I am, classically, I would be connected to Jan, then the really good sales organizations let that happen. And so you forget about job roles and job titles. It's who's in the best position to become trusted by the client and to establish the relationship. And sometimes it's the rep, sometimes it's an SE, sometimes it's someone from corporate headquarters, sometimes it's a consultant, but it's not prescribed. You adapt based on the relationship with the client. And so if as a sales organization, I think you embrace that, it doesn't detract from your technical capabilities. It's actually an enhancement, and it helps two ways. It helps you get the deal and build a relationship. It also helps you personally by widening your network. There are people I now know who 20, 30 years ago were, IT managers, and I've kept the relationship with them. I've built and maintained that relationship, and now they've moved on. Similarly, people that were sales reps 25 years ago, 30 years ago at Oracle, they're now VPs of sales at some large global organizations, but I still have that relationship with them, which makes life much easier for me and my company. So it's a long-term strategy as well as something that's got a lot of short-term benefits.
Yeah. First of all, I would love to be Tim's sales rep. No matter what, because it would mean I would have a really easy life, which would be good. But second of all, and I had that thought already earlier. So when you talked about the role and how it changed and what changed, and now you're saying, so that trusted advisor concept and having that long time relationship, and Tim already said, so you have that kind of classical picture, we supporting opportunities, right? And an opportunity has a start date and an end date, if you will. So we close it and then it's done. So is that really something where you would say this needs to change, right? So being open and really figuring out who should connect to whom and let it flow. And it's completely the right thing to have the pre-sales engineer talking to the CIO on a constant base and maintaining that relationship, which would also mean maybe I'm not doing the same amount of opportunities in the future because I'm more kind of account related and people related, but looking on it on the long run, right? Is that a fair assumption?
It is, given the caveat that you are dealing with enterprise major strategic accounts, right? You know, if you're dealing with SMB, small, medium business, you just don't have the time to do that.
Yeah.
You pick one or two. If, however, you are selling only to two or three large accounts, I would say that it's fundamentally part of your job to do that, because you need to be far more strategic and not just be, you know, the tactical transaction driven. You know, again, Jan, if you're the sales rep selling to me, if the only time I hear from you is when you're trying to close a deal, you know, I know that. If, however, I hear from you as a sales team, you know, in times when you're not trying to close a deal, you know, something's happening. Hey, you know, there's this new white paper. Here's this seminar. You know, wanted to introduce you to somebody else in the business. Then that's the relationship building stuff. And it's making contact when you don't want anything. Maybe you're giving something back instead. That's one of the primary drivers of trust and helps build those relationships. No. And I would say that does not take a large amount of your time. It shouldn't.
No, I mean, I would say, first of all, it takes a very specific mindset, right? Mm-hmm. You need to have as an organization and how you would like to interact internally, but also how you would like to treat your customers at the end of the day.
Exactly. And you know, anybody who's been an SE for more than about 3 months knows there are times that the customer will tell you something they would never, ever tell the salesperson. Tim's smiling. I can see it. So it's happened to you. The really smart salespeople know that and they leverage it. It's one of the powers that we as sales engineers have is customer will tell us things that they probably shouldn't, you know, particularly our fellow techies. So, you know, it's another reason sometimes where you don't always want the sales rep on the call. And quite often the sales rep could be making one call and the SE can be making another call. You know, particularly in the old times when you were roaming the halls of a customer and you'd meet up for lunch at the end of the day or for some important meeting, but otherwise you'd go your own way. Not everything was a four-legged, two-brained sales call. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
I mean, the one thing that is on my mind, and you were citing that study earlier, John, where you talked about how at the customer, different stakeholders perceive the value add of different roles, right? You said, okay, like the sales engineer is perceived 2.5 mm-hmm. times more value bringing in opportunities and engagement as, for example, the rep. And I'm wondering, is there not a huge potential to sort of maybe redefine what account executives should represent and how they're being perceived and maybe how that role should be interpreted to sort of bring more equal weight to it? Because in the end, I think always of us as a team that is sort of working together where both parties have their dedicated responsibilities. And it sounds like such a skew picture.
I think it's a fact of life for salespeople. Now, there's always those fantastic salespeople who very quickly build relationships with the clients, and that's great. And I applaud the salespeople who do that. And I'm not trying to diminish the role of a rep. I've actually been a rep in the past. So I've gone through the pain to unforecast a deal in front of my VP of sales and things like that, which is not a pleasant experience. So as an SE, unless you've actually ever had the role of a salesperson, you need to give them great respect because you know they're like the iceberg. You only see the stuff above the water. You don't see all the other stuff they're doing underneath the water. That said, though, from a customer point of view, if I, again, look at the rep-SC relationship, the relationship that I loved the best was when they were in my office and I could see that they were a team. You know, I mean, to the point where, you know, I there was one couple I would joke. Now, they were like a married couple. They could finish each other's sentences. They knew exactly what they were thinking. And I knew as a buyer that I was in the presence of professionals, you know, but really good professionals. You know? And you kind of respect that, right? So that linkage between the rep and the SE, I think, is super critical if you're trying to build that long-term relationship with a customer. And it needs to be adaptable. And it's not, you know, the rep always does this and the SE always does this. You know, the two of them need to kind of figure out who's best at it for that particular customer. You know? And there are certain things the rep always does, you know, maybe negotiation and pricing. There's some things that the, you know, the SE always does, but there's that gray area in the middle, and every pair, as it were, needs to kind of negotiate who's just that piece in the middle. And I think that what makes a world-class sale team. You know, because a rep can't get the deal without an SE, and the SE is never going to get the deal without the rep, right? So they're two necessary parts. It's how you optimize that that's really the art to everything.
So maybe then there is more truth to that role play that we played earlier, because I've heard people say in my environment that Jan and I sometimes come across as a married couple. So maybe, Jan, you should become an account executive. I'm going to be a sales engineer.
Yeah, as I said, I would love to be your sales rep, Tim.
All right. So, Jan, John, what do you say? Shall we wrap up this conversation? I think there was quite a nice touch at the end talking about the SE sales partnership here, which, of course, we always try to emphasize, right? There should not be silos. There should be a partnership here. And I don't know, Jan, do you have any further questions for John that you want to convey?
I think thousands, but not for today's episode.
John, I can really say I'm extremely happy that you agreed to join us on this call. Both Jan and myself, we are big fans of the what you do here and the contributions you've made to the pre-sales community. I've read that book twice from cover to cover, and in between I always get it out the shelf if I have a dedicated question. So you have certainly influenced what I do on a daily basis, and I'm convinced it's the case for thousands, if not even tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people out there who are in this role on this planet. So thank you for joining us. It definitely was a big honor. Yes.
Well, thank you. I love talking about this. I mean, it's my passion is to improve the profession of pre-sales engineers all across the globe. It's what I do and what's what my company does. And I mentioned to a few people, but a few weeks ago, I signed the contract with my publisher to do the fourth edition of Mastering Technical Sales. So right now, the third edition's been out there for like 5-6 years. We need to, you know, cloudify it and take into account all these things that we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes. So towards the end of 2021, the next edition of Mastering Technical Sales, the handbook, is actually going to come out, totally rewritten, awesome. 145,000 brand new words. So I'm really looking forward to it. That's my project for next year.
Mark your calendars, guys.
Yeah.
End of 2021.
Yeah. Well, you know what release dates are like, right? But that's the plan.
It's on the roadmap. No worries.
Yeah, it's on the roadmap. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Under NDA. Yeah.
Perfect. Then thank you for that teaser, John. And now to you, dear listener, thanks for joining us on this particular episode. We, of course, hope you very much enjoyed our conversation with John. If you did like what you heard, please do follow us on LinkedIn and join us on the Pre-Sales Collective. We do have a German-speaking Slack channel. Join us there or join us on the general communities there. We'd be looking forward to engage with you. Thanks for tuning in, and we speak and hear you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.